Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. I'm delighted to be speaking on the phone today with Terry Wolverton. She is the author of The Labyrinth Reunion. And you know, we're really going to delve into some feminist movement issues, social change, generational issues, and a lot more. But first, a little bit about Terry. Terry Wolverton is an author of 8 books, 2 prose novels, a novel in poems, a memoir, 3 collections of poetry, and a self-published collection of short stories. She has also edited 14 literary anthologies. She is the founder of Writers at Work, a creative writing center in Los Angeles, where she teaches fiction, creative nonfiction, and poetry. She is also an associate faculty mentor in the FA writing program at the Antioch University in Los Angeles. Her recent title is The Labyrinth Reunion, and that's what we're going to be talking to her about. And it's a novel that examines how 2 generations of women regard the feminist movement. Hi, Terry.
Hello, Irene.
I'm really happy to be talking to you today because I think this is a really important topic, and I just really encourage the listeners to stay in tune because we're going to get into some stuff, as I call it. But before we do that, Terry, I would just like you to give a brief overview about your book so this we'll get our listeners sort of into the flow of what we're going to be talking about.
All right. Well, the book is a novel called The Labyrinth Reunion, and The Labyrinth was the double-headed axe of the Amazons in ancient times. And so the book is about kind of women warriors, actually feminists of the 1970s, who are called back together in the 1990s because the daughter of one of them has been raped and murdered. And they come together to comfort her mother, who was a very powerful activist in her day, and also the young woman's friends come together also. And suddenly this situation that has been an occasion for mourning turns into an occasion for conflict in a way, as the 2 generations really disagree about feminism, about how one should respond to violence against women, and everybody has to kind of interrogate and dissect their point of view.
So what happens? I mean, obviously, this is a novel, and it's fiction, but however, what I'm hearing you say is just like, you know, it could be true life right now. And so I'm wondering why, Terry, there is that tension between the 2 generations, or many generations as far as that goes.
Well, I mean, I think that there is always some inherent tension between the generations because, you know, the younger people feel like they know better, and, you know, everybody feels like they know better, really. But I think when it takes place within the context of an activist movement, whether it's the women's movement or the Black liberation movement or the gay and lesbian movement, or I mean, you can see it. I can see it really in all of these social movements that you know, a generation will realize that there is an issue that needs to be dealt with and form a movement around it. And because of their work, things change in society. Sometimes they get a lot better, sometimes they get a little better, but there is change that occurs. So the new generation doesn't face the original set of circumstances. They come in and they may have different circumstances to face, but they don't see the world in the same way that their elders do. And I think particularly because there's always a lot of passion around a social movement, that tension becomes very strong. It's like, why don't you appreciate what I did for you? Or why don't you understand what things were like for us? Or why are you still stuck in the past? And why aren't you looking forward into the future? So all these kinds of issues come up, and that definitely has played out among women in the women's movement and, as I say, among other social movements as well.
I'm listening to you, and it's very basically the generation, you know, as we call it, generation gap, happens not only in social movements, but just in life in general, because I'm thinking of my own, you know, grandmother and now to my grandchildren, the difference. And, of course, there's going to be friction in anything, not only with movements, but even with how we eat or how we dress or our work.
Well, certainly.
Yeah.
You know, it's a human condition, I think.
It sure is. Now, it seems to me that, and you had mentioned this too, that really the feminist movement strongly started in the 1970s. But it seems to me too that there was some type of an undercurrent of movement with the women before as well, but it seemed to be more silent. Am I correct in saying that, or?
Well, you know, we can really look at waves. I mean, really, the original feminist movement goes back to the late 19th and the early 20th centuries, when women were fighting for the right to vote,
mm-hmm.
with the suffragist movement. And that was a very powerful movement, and hundreds of thousands of women were involved in that struggle. And then there was a kind of lapse, and, you know, they actually achieved that victory after many decades of working for it. And then there seemed to be a relaxation I don't really know what to call it. You see, it's not the same kind of movement, but during the Second World War, women had to become empowered because so many of them started working outside the home again while men were off fighting the war. And then there was, when the men returned from the war, there was almost a backlash of trying to reestablish, you know, men in the workforce and men as the head of the household. And so we have these waves. And then by the late 60s, women were sort of chafing under that model again. And the what we would call the modern women's movement of the 1970s, but which is actually considered the second wave of feminism, the suffragist movement being the first wave, starts to come to the fore. And there is this what do they say, history is a pendulum,
right.
You know, and you can see the pendulum in that movement as well as other things.
And it seems to me, too, that now the feminist movement is, again, looks different than what it did in the 1970s.
Very different now.
And how, maybe we can just explain that to our listeners, those that maybe are just sort of getting into this for the first time. What is the difference between now and what it was, let's say, when it was so strong in the 1970s?
That could be a very long answer. I'm going to try to be succinct with it. In the 1970s, you kind of have almost a tipping point, one would say, of a critical mass of women feeling extremely dissatisfied with the options that were available to them. Most women, if they worked outside the home at all, were expected to be secretaries or nurses or teachers. And there was very, you know, it's hard to imagine now because so much has changed in that time. But I know many women who were in university who were told, oh, I don't take my women students very seriously because they're just going to graduate and get married. They're not ever going to do anything with this education. So there was such a low expectation of what women could, should, or would accomplish. And women just got fed up with that, and they began to see that their personal dissatisfaction or unhappiness, which they had been thinking, oh, it's me or it's my husband or I don't know why I can't just accept things like I'm supposed to. When women began to speak to one another, they began to see, no, this is more systemic. There is more of a pattern here. And that, of course, was the great activity of consciousness raising, where women would come together and share their experience in a formal way and kind of try to connect the dots. So it's not just my individual life, but there's really a social circumstance for women that is contributing to this dissatisfaction or this lack of opportunity. And then you began to get these waves of activism, you know, in the workforce, for pay equity, to protest the rape and the kind of violence against women that was happening, for all manner of full human rights, some of which were actually achieved. And any time that things start to get better, then people are more satisfied. And, I mean, that's a good thing. That's what movements want. But often they get a little better, not all the way better, not all the goals are achieved, but people kind of back off that activism. The pressure isn't as great to act. And so I feel like we went through that cycle of very intense activism for probably a period of 10 years or more, and then a kind of retrenchment. Of course, there were people in society who were really trying to fight against the advancement of women, either by, you know, the people who worked to defeat the Equal Rights Amendment, for example. Certain religious organizations felt like, no, we don't want women to be empowered. That's not the biblical way. You know, you have a number of forces who are pushing back. And that also, I think, creates a kind of retrenchment that happens. So I think that now what I observe in women who didn't live through that period, who are younger than me, is that there's no question more opportunity for many women. But of course there's still problems, but they haven't kind of reached that boiling point where people feel, oh, we have to organize ourselves again and really act.
I think that, you know, as I'm listening to you and reflecting back to, I went into the workforce in the 1960s, and it was certainly different than now. I guess we just don't even, as I'm reflecting back, I'm not even considering some of the issues that I had going into the workforce at that time. Now, because of the movements and so on, we are so much more accepted as women. And you've mentioned that there are actually, you know, there's still problems. And so I'd like you to just address those. What are some of the problems that are still hanging over us?
Well, you know, the thing that is most disturbing to me, and this is both within our country but also globally, is this issue of violence against women and the fact that women are still subjected to rape. You know, in some countries, rape is considered a weapon of war, and women are kind of systematically violated in this way. There are countries where women are entirely denied access to education. But even in this country, you know, rape still happens, and women are still murdered, and domestic violence still happens, and you know, that's an issue that I feel like is really, that work is still obviously a matter of life and death, and has yet to be fully addressed within culture, which is not to say it hasn't gotten better. More women are more aware of how to take care of themselves. I had a student in one of my workshops who came in one day to class, and she was very upset, and the night before a man had tried to attack her on the street. But she had fought him, and she had screamed, and, you know, somebody had told her that that was okay to do. And it's not that it wasn't very traumatic to her, but she had successfully fended him off, and he had run because she made a commotion. And there was a time when women didn't even feel like we could do that. I don't want to diminish the progress because I think it's been considerable, but I don't want to rest on our laurels either, because there's a tremendous amount to be done.
Exactly, and it wasn't that long ago when the woman was blamed in the case of rape, Sandy, because the way she dressed, or she was in the wrong place, or the way she looked at the perpetrator. You know, it just, there was so much blame that was put on women.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. We're speaking today with Terry Wolverton, author of The Labyrinth Reunion. What an important topic we're talking about today.
Well, and in countries that are more repressive around the world, we still see that. Women have to cover themselves up because the sight of them would so inflame men that the men can't be responsible for their behavior.
Right.
And there's just that's a whole mindset that, we have a lot of work to do to change that.
We sure do. And I'm so glad to hear and see that actually it is improving. It's not improving as fast enough as to my, the way I would like to see it improve, but it certainly is slowly improving. Terry, today one of the big civil rights issues is centered around same-sex marriage. It's in the news every day. California, and that's where you live, has just, made a big announcement, and I want you to address that. What is going on out there? It's like, gosh, let's just, get over it and be okay with it.
Well, I'm happy you feel that way, but as you know, a lot of people don't. Here's an interesting example of kind of generational difference. Within my own era of activism as a feminist and as a lesbian, we were very much against marriage. We thought it was a terrible institution. We thought it was an institution about property rights. And, when a woman married a man, she basically was owned by him. And, that was the tradition it came out of. And we were all about free love and, autonomy, personal autonomy, and not being beholden to anyone. So that was our sort of take on it. And now we have a generation, and I don't mean to say there are certainly people my age who are very much involved in this struggle for marriage rights, but it's kind of fomented by a generation who they're not worried about fighting for their survival as gays and lesbians. They're on to the next thing. They're into let's be like everybody else. My generation didn't want to be like everybody else. We wanted to change the culture entirely. But now there's we want the same rights. We want to be able to walk down the aisle and register at Target. And so that's a kind of interesting example of how an issue can shift, or if the focus of a movement can shift from generation to generation. And, for many of the people who are opposed to same-sex marriage, it becomes a vehicle for, they don't want gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered people to have full rights. And, marriage becomes the hot button of this, it's this sacred institution. Of course, meanwhile, more than half of the marriages end in divorce, at least in this state. So, it's obviously not that sacred. And it, you know, the thing that always seems to me is that more people marrying, particularly if they can stay married, would only strengthen the institution of marriage, not dismantle it, which the opponents feel.
You know, you mentioned the younger generations, and I had an opportunity to, my granddaughter was here, she just turned 17, and I took her to New Orleans for 5 days, and we were in one of the restaurants, and it was the fellow that came, he was in drag, and he came and he sat with us, and it was just the neatest conversation, and it really opened up for her. She had never met a person in drag before, and so it opened up a whole new world to her. And then once he left, we had such a great conversation, and I really wanted to explore what goes on in the generation of the 16, 17, 18-year-olds in this and what the acceptance is. And, you know, it's accepted. It's like, it's no big deal. They're just ordinary people. And I was so glad to hear that there was just wasn't that, you know, that generation just does not feel as some of the older generations as you know, just talked about. So it was really refreshing for me to be able to talk to her about that. I don't see her, you know, I just see her once a year, so we talk a lot about different things. And this is one of them, so.
That's really great.
Yeah, yeah. So this novel of yours, I mean, obviously, the topic is very close to your heart. What we talked about, you know, as much of that is reflected in your book. And it really does depict social history, doesn't it? And I would assume that's the intent of what you wanted.
It is. You know, I'm very interested in the novel as a social document, as a way of reflecting the world, and not only individual lives within that world, but really something about the world around it. And during the 1970s, there were some novels that were written kind of in the moment about what was going on in the women's movement. But I felt that then, you know, that topic was kind of dropped, and there hadn't been a more retrospective look about what do we think now about that time period that was so momentous in a certain way in so many women's lives. So I wanted to see if I could use the device of the novel to cast that wider lens. And I, you know, I would say it's not easy to do. But it was a worthy challenge. It took me a long time to write this book, and you know, I learned a lot in the process of doing it.
Well, I'm sure you did, because there's always a lot of research to be done. So, did you use any of the characters that maybe, you know, did you model them after some people that you know, or some incidences that happened in the book? Are these like true to life, but of course you fictionalized them?
There are characters that are loosely based on people that I know,
mm-hmm.
Particularly if somebody was strongly representative of a particular strand, if you will, of the women's movement. And in the book, there are some real events that are referred to, kind of in a historical context, but the events within the novel themselves are. Within the novel itself are fictional.
You pretty much have to, don't you? You know, in order to do a novel. But as you had just mentioned, many authors do the same thing as what you did. You know, sort of characterize. So, the bottom line with this feminist movement, where do you think it's going, or where do you hope it's going? Maybe that's how I should rephrase that.
Well, I. Where is it going?
Where is it going? Yeah.
I cannot predict to you when will be the next time that women will coalesce, particularly as women, to work for women's issues. I don't have a crystal ball that would tell me that. What I see is women who are very active in a spectrum of issues, from the environment to anti-war movements, to economic justice, and those are all issues that do impact women. In a certain way, oh boy, this is controversial, but yeah, I'll say it. In a certain way, I almost feel that the singular focus on one issue, just women's rights or just whatever, whatever it happens to be, is not appropriate for our time. It's not that I want women's issues to be forgotten or how all issues impact women. I think that's critical to remember, but I don't know that things in the world seem to be in great need of remedy to me. And to just say, I'm just going to sit here and I'm just going to focus on this one pocket of people, that no longer seems like a strategy for the time that we're living in.
You know, Terry, I so agree with you, because that's what's in my mind, too. Because, you know, when I look back, and let's say the 1970s, we'll use that because we've been using that year, you know, the focus was different. But now, like you say, it's environment, it's anti-war, it's economic issues, it's gay, lesbian issues. I mean, this goes on and on and on. And there are so many. And so I agree with you. It's not only one issue.
And, you know, of course, it's challenging to have the time and energy to keep all those issues in one's head. And, you know, we probably do have to work kind of one at a time. You know, if I'm going to make phone calls for something, I can only make phone calls for one thing. But it's more the way that we, it's more the worldview that we're really thinking, okay, how is this impacting poor people? How is this impacting people in other countries? How is this impacting children? How is this impacting seniors? So that we're not just focused on how is this impacting me and my group.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can see that historically that singular focus has been very convenient for, let's say, the dominant power group to manipulate. One of the reasons that women were given the vote when they were is because African Americans had won the vote some years earlier, and there was the belief that, oh, if white women vote, they'll counteract the black vote. And that's actually the reason that women won the vote. So we have to be very careful about how we allow our interests to be used in ways that ultimately are against our interests, if we define our interests broadly.
Exactly, exactly. Terry, what is your website address?
It is www.terrywolverton.xbuild. Just an X and the word build.com.
Great. Thank you so much, Terry, for what an, you know, this is such a timely topic. I mean, we're, you know, this is all in the news right now, and we're just right darn in the middle of it. So thank you so much for giving us more light on this really important topic.
I so appreciate the time to have the conversation with you, Irene.
And listeners, there you go. Check out Terry's novel, The Labyrinth Reunion, and I know that you're going to find it extremely interesting, and as I say, it's very timely, too, and it's really going to give you that insight of all the issues that really do still go on in with women. And again, listeners, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for listening to this, and again, Terry, thanks a lot for showing up.
Thank you.
This is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Bye for now.